You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, July 11th, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Ben Tarnoff, co-founder of Logic Magazine, author of Internet for the People, the Fight for Our Digital Future. Meanwhile, Joe Biden's polling is falling off a cliff. Even Democrats want a different presidential candidate in 2 years. Meanwhile, day late, dollar short, as Biden asks his staff to assess his authority to declare a public emergency over the abortion ruling.
Needs a new memo to decide.
New memo. Couldn't ask him before because, well, of the thing. DOJ skeptical of Steve Bannon's offer to testify to the January 6th committee. Louisiana judge denies an extension on a restart of an abortion ban as the Pennsylvania Senate pushes an anti-abortion state constitutional amendment. In D.C., the Senate returns as Democrats look to pass a fraction of the Build Back Better bill. And as BA5 rages in the states, concerns mount over the Uber Omicron BA2.75. Leaked to Guardian newspaper shows that Uber, speaking of Uber, broke laws and did secret lobbying. Lastly, Elon Musk bails on his contract to buy Twitter as conservative fever dreams vaporize. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us today. It is Monday, the beginning of a new week. Joining me as always, Emma Vigeland. Hello, Emma.
Hello, Sam.
Well, look at that. Am I a little bit misaligned here? Let me do this. How was your weekend?
It was fine. It was fine.
Great.
Yeah.
That sounds great.
Well, I mean, I had some good sushi. That's really about it.
All right. Well, Sox won, so I was pretty excited about that.
And Saul's into it now.
That was a good game. That was
Saul,
a fun game.
Yeah, I don't know. It's hard to know whether he's just trying to stay up or what, but he was psyched this morning. He didn't, you know, he did say, I can't remember whose home run it was. I can't remember which home run it was, but he said, I think the Sox are turning this around. And I think it was like 6-3 or 6-4 at the time, and he had to go to bed. And then he wakes up in the morning. It's 12-6.
Wow.
So, folks, on Friday, I did a shout out to the moderators of both our Twitch and, our Discord and our YouTube. And I somehow neglected to shout out our OG YouTube moderator, Autumn Leaves. I thought I said Autumn Leaves. I feel like I read it.
Well, it might have been my fault because I had a screenshot and then I added Autumn Leaves to the screenshot.
That's what you did. Mm. But so shout out to all of our moderators. Really appreciate it. Particularly, you know, you bring up Destiny's name. And, well, he was a big Twitch streamer, I guess, and there's a lot of chatters and chat people. They came in, and that sometimes it can be a little challenging.
So please end your strike, Autumn Leaves.
Yeah. Oh, are they striking?
I think it was a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but if not, you know, I hope this meets your demands.
Oh, all right. I didn't know. I capitulated without even – I was negotiating against myself.
I have no idea what the hell is going on right now.
Forget about it. For the workers.
Okay. Yep. Thanks for joining us this week, folks. I don't know what to tell you. I mean, the Biden administration seems to have. It's almost like the closest thing I can say is it's like, you know, there is a book when you play blackjack. There really is no controversy. There are some places where you can go where they break down the odds in a far more micro level. But there's essentially a book that exists for blackjack. It is actually there are if you want to play the highest amount of averages, you can do that in blackjack. They still favor the house. You need to get some luck, but you can play the whole, every scenario is already mapped out for you.
There's a recipe.
Yes, there is a recipe. And some of it gets a little controversial. Like, I can't remember what it was, but there was one thing I was taught by a dealer to like hit an 11, like an ace and a 10 against a six. And people freak out when you do that at the table with good reason. I was like, this is insane, but I started doing it anyways.
Well, you have two options that way, right?
But well, yes. Statistically speaking, it is favored. Most people won't do that because
they're idiots.
You got something in your pocket already. Yeah, but yeah. This guy was like, you got to do that, particularly at a two-thirds, you know, where the odds are. That's what it is. It's in a table where the odds aren't as high because they've changed it in some places. But my point on this is sometimes you see people who are like, don't hit on a 16.
Yeah.
And it gets a little aggravating. But then sometimes you see people who don't hit on a 16, and then the next time they hit on a 16, and then the next time they don't hit on a 16. And it's like, that's the worst thing you can do is to switch around. Or maybe you hit on a 13 and you don't the next time. That's what it feels like the Biden administration is doing. They are making – so, for instance, the Biden administration comes out yesterday and leaks or reports or tells the press that Biden has asked his staff to assess whether he has the authority to declare a public emergency, health emergency, and what resources the federal government could bring to bear. This is a great idea for Biden to do 5 weeks ago.
You could have just declared the public health emergency as opposed to seeking a memo from your staff, which is like going to be in the same black hole where the student debt memo is residing.
But that's not even my point. That's not even my point. My point is, why is this happening today? Like if you're going to do this, why didn't you ask for your authority before the thing came out? Why?
Like, he doesn't want the authority, really.
This is, but then don't do it. That's what I'm saying. Like,
it's a press release. What this is.
But by announcing that they're doing it today, the message is, this is something we could do. Ask the staff what my authority is. And it's something that we didn't think was important to do until 2 weeks after the decision. Like, it's not only is it hitting on the 16, but the next time it's not hitting on the 16. It's like, stick with a plan. But now they're just, by coming out with this today, they make it look like they didn't do anything.
There's consistency there, though, is that they will not do anything unless they are forced to act. And when they're forced to act, they're probably not going to do anything anyway because they just want to look like they're acting. That they want to galvanize people to the polls in the fall based on Roe being overturned while they're pretending to type on their computer while the boss man walks by. Like, that's what is.
But my point is that they're typing on the computer as the boss man walks by the fourth time. Like, that's my point. I don't think that there is much they can do. But if you're going to put on a show, put it on when it's relevant, not now. Because, I mean, here's a perfect example. Joe Biden's White House communications director comes out with this. Her name is Kate Bedingfield. She says Joe Biden's goal in responding to Dobbs is not to satisfy some activists who have been consistently out of step with the mainstream of the Democratic Party.
Oh, screw off.
What the hell does that even mean?
Is it really out of the mainstream of the Democratic Party? Because my the inbox that I have with fundraising emails in all caps red from Nancy Pelosi seems to disagree. Like, they have been running on this constantly, and now they want to kick activists? They ran on... This is the same thing. Abortion and racial justice are two issues, and gun control, three issues, where they say they want to take action, they want to do everything in their power, and they use it as a way to get money from the suburban voters that they're courting, and then they do nothing when they're in office. This is the moment that they were supposed to be here for. When Roe was overturned.
This is what is so bizarre about this, is that I am trying to just like put on my, you know, mind reading cap and figure out what it is that they thought they were doing with this. You know, this isn't like some, you know, somebody who has no, let's say, communications experience. And I mean, what is it they were trying to do? Like, who is this message for? And it's almost like we're trying to appeal to this very, very narrow sliver of people who are in the suburbs, who might be offended by people who are really going, it's the same problem they have had forever, which is they are sort of like half doing this. And here is, and then they realize like, oh, this was a massive mistake.
Their coalition's falling apart because there were people who voted for him and worked on his behalf that feel offended by this.
Here is the former Biden National Coalition's director, Ashley Allison. And this is just like, it's just unbelievable. We set out to, the idea is we want to set out to, like, because, you know, frankly, those suburban voters they want to reach, they're not paying attention to what the White House communications director is saying. But the people who are paying attention are the activists who have been working on this. It's just so dumb. It's unbelievable. Here is the former Biden National Coalition's director, Ashley Allison, responding on CNN.
The Democratic Party. What was your response to that, Ashley?
I was disappointed in that statement. As an activist, as someone, she nodded to the coalition that Joe Biden built. I ran the coalition's department on that campaign. Guess who was a part of that coalition? Activists. In 2020, when people took to the streets because of the death of George Floyd, it invigorated the base in a way that allowed us to have record turnout. Now, yeah, we were fighting an authoritarian president like Donald Trump, but these people going into the street saying that we need a bodily autonomy, that is the excitement that Democrats need right now ahead of the midterms. And to demonize them and say, you know, they're not mainstream. Well, abortion is a very popular issue in the country, and it goes across Democratic and Republican lines. I think it was an unforced error, and I hope they address it. I'm not sure they will, but I took it offense to it, and a lot of people have.
I mean, why wouldn't you?
It's a good point, too, because their only message in response to abortion rights being stripped for millions of women in this country has been go vote in the fall. But, like, the people who ostensibly would help mobilize people in the fall, activists who are on the ground on this issue on abortion, they're kicking, right, as they're trying to fight their hardest.
This is really reminiscent of the Obama administration's disdain for outside activists and Rahm Emanuel's famous, you know, F the left. And that did not work out so well, particularly in off-year elections. And I think, you know, Joe Biden does not have nearly the popularity that Barack Obama did when he came in. I mean, this is just it feels like an administration that's completely rudderless.
And the fact that this is being said by someone who worked with him on national television on State of the Union on Sunday, there's blood in the water here. Yep. Like the some Democratic, you know, people within the, you know, establishment circles understand that they need to jump ship on Biden.
I mean, it's early, but this does not bode well for him. And the interesting thing will be how much will this impact the Senate and House races. But we will find out. All right, in a minute we will be talking to Ben Tarnoff, co-founder of Logic Magazine, author of Internet for the People, the fight for our digital future, just after these messages from our sponsors. I came into the office today. I think I was a little dehydrated, so I was feeling a little dizzy. I immediately filled up my bottle of my liquid IV.
What flavor?
I've been going with tangerine all the time now. Like, I see the watermelon, which I usually like, but then I'm like, why wouldn't I also go with the immune therapy?
Watermelon's so good.
Watermelon's so good. But meanwhile, it's super hot out there. Super hot. And you gotta stay hydrated. One stick of liquid IV and 16 ounces of water hydrates you 2 times faster and more efficiently than water alone. Plus, it tastes great. 10 refreshing flavors. They have lemon lime. They have Concord grape, actually. We have a Concord grape over there. Tropical punch. Still going with the tangerine and the watermelon and the pina colada. Liquid and the matcha. Liquid IV contains 5 essential vitamins, B3, B5, B6, B12, and vitamin C. With Liquid IV, you get 3 times the electrolytes of traditional sports drinks, and it's made with premium ingredients. It's non-GMO. It's free from gluten, dairy, and soy. They use this science of cellular transport technology, which basically means that Liquid IV has the right combination of minerals and vitamins, so you get enhanced rapid absorption of water and other key ingredients into the bloodstream, of course. Liquid IV is on a mission to change the world. The company's donated over 24 million servings globally. Great if you've had too much to drink. Great when it's hot this hot out. Great when you're traveling. I mean, it's my everyday drink, frankly. Grab your Liquid IV in bulk nationwide at Costco, or you can get 25% off when you go to liquidiv.com. Use the code MajorityRep at checkout. 25% off anything you order. And you shop better hydration today using promo code MajorityRep at liquidiv.com. And there's a special, folks. Sunset Lake Sebade.com. As you know, usually left is best, gets you 20% off. Well, Sunset Lake has a big, big sale on their tinctures. This is where I head immediately to the website and stock up, which is not to say that I'm going, trying to just waiting for the sale like this, because I didn't know it was coming. Scout's honor, but I'm going big time. I'm going hard. Sunset Lake Sebade has a wide variety of Sebade tinctures. It's something for everybody. You need something to go to sleep? They have Sebade melatonin tincture you take before bed for a better night's sleep. They also have high potency 3,000 milligram and 6,000 milligram tinctures, perfect for catching a mellow buzz and reducing stress after a long day at work. Starting today until next Monday at 11:59 p.m., so all week, all Sebade tinctures will be 35% off with the coupon code Tincture, T-I-N-C-T-U-R-E. I've been using these things for now multiple years, I guess 2 years, 3 years more for sleep. They've been invaluable. Sometimes the kids are getting a little bit difficult. I will also mellow myself out on the weekend. They're fantastic. And as always, with all the Sunset Lake Sebade products, third-party analysis of what's in there, different versions. They also have original flavor and some mint and citrus. Starting today, all Sebade tinctures will be 35% off with the coupon code Tincture. Visit sunsetlakesebade.com to try these amazing new products and take advantage of this sale while it lasts. Sale ends July 18th. Check it out. All right. Do we need to take a quick break? We'll take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Ben Tarnoff, co-founder of Logic Magazine, author of Internet for the People, The Fight for Our Digital Future. We are back. Sam Cedar, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report on the phone-ish computer thing, on the ping. We have Ben Tarnoff. He is the co-founder of Logic Magazine, author of The Internet for the People, The Fight for Our Digital Future. Ben, welcome to the program. I'm here with Emma Vigeland.
Hey, so much, thanks so much for having me, Sam and Emma. Appreciate it.
Of course.
All right. So let's just start with something, you know, ostensibly remedial, which is, what is the internet? Like, when we're talking about the internet, what are you talking about?
No, it's a great question, Sam, and it's not remedial at all. Actually, one of the reasons I wrote this book is I was trying to figure out the answer to that question. Because if you think about it, we talk about the internet all the time as if we think we know how it works. You know, there's kind of assumption. But in fact, the truth is much stranger. And I would say, you know, the short answer to your question is that the internet is fundamentally a language. It's a language that lets different computer networks from all around the country interconnect to form a global network of networks. But to find that answer, I had to go back into the history of how the internet was created.
Which leads me to my next question. How is the internet created? And because I don't think, you know, I mean, I remember when this was happening, and I remember, you know, I was in my 30s as the internet was really becoming online. I still have a old style email address that people laugh at when they see it sometimes. And I remember CompuServe and AOL and The Well and all those things.
Yeah.
But walk us through this, because this is instructive and gets to your point as to the road not taken and maybe the road that we can sort of hop back on.
Yeah. So I have a similar history, Sam. I mean, I started using the internet in the 90s, AOL, CompuServe, Prodigy, that era. But the real history of the internet begins about 20 years before that. So the first internet protocol, which is this language that I mentioned that allows computers to communicate with one another, is actually created in the mid-1970s. And it comes out of a Pentagon project. I think folks vaguely know when they know about the internet that it comes out of government funding. But it's interesting, the specific mission objective that motivated the internet experiments, which was in the 1970s, the Pentagon has a number of different computers, but those computers are basically too large and too expensive to deploy into the battlefield. So they want to create a way in which a big mainframe in Northern Virginia that's running a computer program could communicate with a Jeep or a bomber, some soldiers that are deployed out in the field. And the way they do this is by creating an internet protocol, a language that would allow this network of networks to interconnect so that, let's say, a soldier in a Jeep somewhere in Vietnam with a smaller computer could actually access a program running on a mainframe in Northern Virginia. So that is the dream that produced the internet, of using networked computing power to project American power abroad.
Well, that's sort of a bummer in a way, right? I mean, like, you know, you would hope that it would have been the objective of the internet would not be how can we more efficiently kill people, but it is what it is. And so where does it go from there?
So it is, you know, created with that end in mind, but it's not actually used for that, if that makes us feel a bit better about the internet.
It
so
it
has these military
origins.
I'm glad. Yeah, it's not immediately used to kill people. Of course, later on, it will facilitate that purpose. But, you know, the DARPA, which is the Pentagon's R&D arm, it has to pursue projects that may have some military application, even if they're fairly blue sky. So that's the pretext for funding the creation of the internet protocols. But what the Pentagon actually uses the internet for when it appears is to interconnect its fixed line networks, a kind of more banal purpose, which is the Pentagon, as you can imagine, has a bunch of computer networks lying around. It wants to make it possible for these networks to speak to one another, for them to transact data. So it uses the internet protocol in order to do that. And what happens is over the course of the 1980s, this network of networks grows. And in particular, it becomes civilianized. So it remains under the control of the federal government, but it's primarily at this point, by the late 1980s, used by academic researchers, you know, people on university campuses all over the country with sites overseas. And they're using it, you know, by and large to email one another. So it becomes a kind of scientific collaboration tool.
How did it get from that to a private enterprise, right, and become more towards, privatization, transitioning towards that? Because, I mean, we all know that there's a massive overlap between the Pentagon and private contracts, but, like, how did that transition begin?
Yeah, that's a great question, Emma. Yeah, Gore plays a role. You know, I feel like Gore is a punchline when it comes to the history of the internet, but he actually is all over it. So
yep.
Turns out there's something to that joke. But yeah, that's a great question, Emma. And that's, you know, largely what my book is about. How was the internet privatized? And this happens in many phases. It takes really decades. But the first piece of this puzzle starts in the 90s. So by the early 90s, the National Science Foundation, which is a federal agency tasked with supporting basic research, is running the internet. So it's no longer the Pentagon. It's now a civilian but federal agency. And they have a situation where demand to get online far exceeds capacity. So as we mentioned before, it's primarily restricted to academic researchers, but a lot more people want to get on the internet because now you've got the World Wide Web, you've got the first graphical web browsers, things like Netscape. It's easier to be online. It's more interesting. It's a richer, more interactive experience. So what the National Science Foundation decides to do is to privatize the internet sooner than expected. So crucially, privatization was always the plan. The federal government had no intention of running the internet indefinitely. But they decided to move up the time frame for privatization because demand so far outstripped capacity. And this privatization, the most important thing for us to understand is that this privatization took a particularly extreme form. It happened very quickly. The terms of these conditions were dictated unilaterally by the telecoms. And privatization, particularly as it takes place in 1995, which is the year in which the National Science Foundation shuts down its core infrastructure and the private sector takes over. The terms of privatization in 1995 would ensure a total corporate dictatorship over the infrastructure of the internet. And this, to my mind, is the origin point for many of the problems that plague the modern internet.
All right. And I want to get into that part about it specifically. But can you, like, just tangibly give us a sense more tangibly? Like, for instance, I know the story of Chicago privatizing some of its parking meters. And that I mean, that's pretty straightforward. The parking meters are there, and now this private company is in charge of administering them and, and they give a fee to the government, and that's it. How did it work in this way? Like, are there subsets of the internet, like the last mile, that type of thing, or, you know, to where the servers are? Like, how do you, like, what did, like, literally what happened to privatize it?
Yeah, that's a great question because, you know, sometimes when we talk about privatization, we talk about the literal transfer of public assets to the private sector, right? You know, if you privatize a port that used to be run by the government, now it's run by a private firm. That's not what happened in the case of the internet. When we talk about privatization, particularly privatization that began in 1995, what we have to understand is that the federal government essentially was using its power to determine what the shape of the network would look like. And it decided to use that power in such a way as to maximize private sector control and to minimize or even outright eliminate any possibility of a public or non-commercial foothold in the new network. So what literally happens on April 1995 is that the National Science Foundation shuts down its core infrastructure, what was called the backbone of the internet. Now, we still have backbones today, although there are many of them. A backbone is a core artery. If you think about the internet as a circulation system, that's kind of the core artery. And then when we get to broadband, to the so-called last mile that helps people like us get online, you could think of those as the capillaries of the system. Now, as you might imagine, the backbone is pretty important. If you control the backbone, arguably you control the network. And the federal government controlled the backbone, which gave it immense power to determine how this transition was going to happen. So it's not as if it simply hands over a bunch of cables to private companies, because those private companies have their own cables. But it is in a position to dictate the terms of the transition, and that transition is done in such a way as to ensure total corporate dictatorship over essential infrastructure.
How could, maybe it's too early to ask this question, but how could it have been different? Like, it's just so that we can illustrate, you know, what they did. How, what could they have done differently?
Yeah. So one of the things I try to talk about in my book is all of these different moments when it could have gone a different way, because there were people arguing for the possibility of alternate ways of organizing the internet. So during these debates around privatization in the first half of the 1990s, Senator Daniel Inouye from Hawaii introduces a Senate bill that is supported by a group called the Telecommunications Policy Roundtable, which is a group of activists, scholars, union cadre, you name it, who are trying to push for a more democratic approach to the future of the internet. And Inouye's bill would have reserved up to 20% of telecom capacity for public uses. This capacity would have been provided to qualifying institutions like libraries and other non-commercial organizations that serve the public for free. And such organizations would also have received a funding stream to develop their own online programming. A major inspiration for this so-called public lane on the information superhighway, as the idea was called, was public media. And if you think about it, you know, when we had radio, when we had television, we still have those things, but when we were beginning to figure out how to regulate them, a number of people came together and pushed for the idea that there should be non-commercial portions of the spectrum that should be devoted to public uses. So Inouye and other activist figures were trying to figure out what would that mean for the internet. Now, of course, as you can expect, this proposal was roundly defeated by the telecom lobby, but it gives us a glimmer of an alternative of what the internet could have been.
So are we talking, in terms of that Inouye proposal, are we talking about, have we skipped over the pipes into what's going through the pipes? Or have we said, we don't know what's going to go through those pipes, but 20% of the pipes are going to be dedicated to whatever these nonprofit entities come up with? Like, I mean, so like, could we have said, okay, we're going to control the pipes? Like, for instance, like we're gonna control the electrical grid, and we're gonna allow maybe some providers to come and traverse over those grids, but you're gonna do it on our terms, and we're gonna have, you know, some say over it because we got the pipes. Is that, this wasn't the pipes, right? That seems like it was completely skipped over.
Yeah, so we're still talking about the pipes, Sam. That 20% of capacity would have been at the level of the infrastructure. And, you know, I think you raise a good point, which is that there are a lot of different possible configurations for how the internet could have been popularized without being fully privatized. So you could have had a situation in which the federal government says, you know what, we're going to retain control of the backbone, but, you know, last mile providers, internet service providers, that can be private. Alternatively, you know, at the time, the National Science Foundation was subsidizing these nonprofit regional ISPs that were helping people get online. So another path forward could have been, you know what, we're going to continue to subsidize those networks so that we can make universal connectivity a social right for all Americans. There were also organizations called Freenets, which were quite popular at the time. There was one in Cleveland in particular that were often, you know, based in libraries, but you could also dial up from home. If you think about BBSs, Sam, of that era, the 1990s, these were free ways that people could get online. And in fact, the creator of the Cleveland Freenet wanted to get federal money to sprinkle Freenets all across the country. So there were so many different configurations that were available. But what we didn't have was a social movement that was capable of overcoming telecom opposition and actually thinking creatively about how we could democratize the internet.
how did this kind of pair with, I'm reminded of how Bill Gates, as Microsoft CEO, he was not known to be this amazing developer, but that, you know, why he's wealthy to the degree that he is now is because of intellectual property and protecting private ownership of a lot of this. You know, him, his career and the beginnings of it when he was essentially trying to end open source software development. I know that's not the same thing as the internet, but were those two things working in tandem because there was a lot of corporate pressure to privatize and silo these things off?
Certainly. I think it belongs to the same impulse. And I remember that era quite well. I was a Linux fanatic and Bill Gates was, you know, the devil. I mean, it's funny because he's later rehabilitated his image so successfully. But of course, in the 90s,
not,
you know,
around
he was
here.
Widely perceived.
Not around here.
Good. I'm glad to hear
As
it.
As a non-Linux user, I can tell you not around here, but go ahead.
There you go. Yeah. Well, Windows has gotten a bit better, but certainly he was perceived as a villainous figure, you know, in popular culture. But I think what you're talking about, Emma, is the impulse to erect walled gardens, to create proprietary alternatives, to lock people in, to create funding streams. You know, that was happening, obviously, with Microsoft's business model. It was also happening on the web. You know, if you think about the dot-com boom in the latter half of the 1990s, people are trying to take this network that was built by and for research scientists that runs on open, non-proprietary protocols, in which open source is, even before we had the term open source, that was just the paradigm of the internet, which makes sense because scientists want to be able to collaborate with one another as easily as possible. One of the wonderful things about having government control and decades of public management was not just patient funding of this technology, but an open source ethic where collaborators and contractors had to share source code with one another, because the point here was not to enable private profit, it was to build the system. So there is a collision, if you like, of those two worldviews in the 1990s. And I think the Linux, you know, Windows war is one of the sites of that confrontation, but there are certainly others as well.
So, and back in the 90s, if you wanted to get online and you weren't adept, right? I mean, if you were sort of like a newbie, you would get CompuServe or you would get AOL and you would sort of be stuck within their world, essentially. Even as you went to other things on the internet, you would go through their portal and they would create this sense that you're still in the AOL world on some level, if I remember using it that way. And on some level, like, we still sort of have that, except for it's just a little bit less constraining. It's almost like in those days, it felt like you were sort of in a cage. And now it's more like you're in a reserve. It appears to be like a natural setting, but it's actually sort of, you know, constrained on some level. So tell us the difference, and you don't refer to them as platforms, because here's the other question. It's like, it's one thing to say, because I remember when the Tennessee thing happened, and you write about that, that we're going to provide internet access for everybody, a municipality. And there was a sense like, this is going to happen everywhere, except for the telecoms did a good job of shutting it down in, I think, almost 20 states across the country. So if there was any impetus to do it, they headed off at the pass. But that's how you get onto the internet. And if you could do that, obviously, it gives these providers a lot less leverage. But what about once you're on there? I mean, how would, if we can imagine the government maintaining at least some assets in terms of the backbone of the internet, which presumably would then give them more opportunity to dictate the shape of it and to propose more regulations, I guess, presumably, and also to maintain the trajectory of the growth of the internet. What about, like, in terms of platforms? Like, is there a role, you know, one of the ongoing debates we've had around here for years, and it's, you know, is, like, should the government take over Twitter? should it be nationalized because of the nature of it? And I'm curious from your perspective, like what of that? Like where you know, where does the idea of nationalization and maybe antitrust and regulation like we have for power companies, give me your sense of what could have been and what maybe should be.
Yeah, I think this is a difficult issue, Sam, and I think we have to acknowledge the difficulty right away, because when we're moving up the stack, so to speak, of the internet, we are now encountering an altitude, if you like, a layer of the internet in which the creatures are much more complex and much more different from one another. So Facebook is vastly more complex than Comcast, and Facebook and Uber and Amazon are much more different from one another than, say, Comcast, AT&T, and Verizon. So what that means to my mind is that we have to develop a range of strategies that's comparably diverse. In the book, I point to a number of experiments across the internet where some interesting rudiments of an alternative are emerging. In the case of social media, there's an open source project called Mastodon, for instance, where folks are running their own social media sites and then interconnecting with one another to form federations along the same open, non-proprietary interoperability principle that the internet or a popular application like email runs on. What's interesting about Mastodon and these other experiments in the decentralized web is that people are trying to figure out answers to these questions of what would a cooperatively run social media site look like? How could we make certain content moderation decisions on a community basis if profit maximization wasn't the overriding principle? Now, I think in general, these are promising experiments, but we do have to go further, because when we think about, you know, Twitter, you mentioned the idea of nationalizing Twitter or nationalizing Facebook or cooperativizing Facebook. One of the things I think we have to be careful about is that these technologies are not neutral. You know, Facebook has been built from the ground up to maximize user engagement in order to advance its business model. And as we've seen, that priority on user engagement at all costs has greatly favored the proliferation of right-wing propaganda. It favors sensationalistic, provocative, inflammatory content that has been very successfully weaponized by the right. So the idea in that case of simply taking that architecture over, putting it under new ownership, would not, in my view, mitigate many of the destructive downstream social consequences. So we have to create new architectures through a new process of experimentation.
So, okay. And so essentially, we don't really have on this layer of the level of the internet, when we talk about the internet, we're talking about the sort of application level. We don't have almost the we don't have enough examples of what a Facebook would look like that was not intended to drive profit. Like it's almost like there, you know, like it's hard to conceive of what the functioning of that Facebook would be that is not, you know, with a profit motive. So, and I understand that concept. Like, I mean, if you sit down and say, like, the objective, this is our bottom line, everything is going to be built relative to that foundation that you lay down there. If you say our bottom line is different, it is not to make profits. It is to increase people's feeling of interconnectivity, let's say, or something to that effect. The foundation you build is set, and what the structure on top of that is going to look different. Would we have a different app level structure if the pipe level, well, you said like Comcast versus in AT&T and all these providers, if that had remained in government hands, would the superstructure above it look different just because that primary foundation was not for profit?
I think it would, Sam. And I like the use of base and superstructure here, because I think this also gives us more motivation to transform the pipes of the internet. You mentioned Chattanooga, Tennessee. You know, we have more than 900 so-called community networks across the United States right now. These are publicly or cooperatively owned broadband networks that tend to provide better service at lower cost than their corporate counterparts. I think, Sam, as you also mentioned, there are almost 20 states in which telecom lobbyists have successfully erected barriers to actually creating these networks, which is very underhanded and something we have to fight. But creating a beachhead, if you like, in the base of the internet, showing people that alternative models are possible, that it's possible to create a local network with other members of your community. It's possible to come together to have in-person deliberative discussions about how that infrastructure should be deployed, what kind of priorities you're going to make. That's critical because it builds a democratic muscle. It shows people that there are alternative ways of organizing the resources on which their life depends. And this is partly why telecoms are terrified of community networks. You know, it's not that they really think that, a few hundred networks are going to erode their profit margins. They're terrified of a good example because the demonstration effect could show people that there's nothing inevitable about the current arrangement. And that sense that there's nothing inevitable, that we can create real alternatives, is what's going to help us up the stack at the application layer as well.
You write about the Equitable Internet Initiative in Detroit, I think it was, right? Would you just tell us about that as we talk about sort of some of these alternate, constructions of the internet?
So the Equitable Internet Initiative is a project run by the Detroit Community Technology Project, and they're going into poor working class neighborhoods in Detroit, installing internet infrastructure, helping people get connected for free or at low cost. And crucially, they're pulling these people into a broader organizing project. It's not merely, hey, we're here to install internet, get you set up and walk away. We're actually trying to build relationships among these different households. A lot of the people in these households are elderly. They don't have a lot of experience using computers and the internet. So they need guidance on how to stay connected with their grandkids, on how to access government services. And I talk about it in the book as an inspiring example of, you know, a small scale, but nonetheless thriving community initiative in which people are not just getting people connected, but enhancing the connectivity, the connectedness of neighborhoods and pulling it into a broader political project.
How many communities do you know don't have access to broadband and to the internet? Because I feel like the traditional thought is that it's available anywhere and anybody can get it, but obviously there are significant barriers and we're still very behind in rural communities in particular.
Absolutely. And these numbers are astonishing. I was surprised when I was doing the research for this book. So in 2018, Microsoft researchers found that 162 million Americans do not use the internet at broadband speeds. So that's nearly half the country. It's just an astonishing number. And as you indicate, Emma, the underconnected and the unconnected are disproportionately rural, low income, people of color, and they live in communities that simply are not profitable for the telecoms to invest in. Now, even those of us who are fortunate enough to live in communities where there is some infrastructure and who can afford to pay it are still getting terrible service. You know, Americans pay higher rates on average for our internet service than Europeans or people in Asia. And in return, we have some of the worst service. You know, in terms of average connection speeds, I think we currently rank 14th, which is below Hungary and Thailand. So we have a failed system, and we have severe inequalities in broadband access that has real human costs. We saw that during the COVID pandemic, during the early days of the pandemic. Folks didn't have internet at home. They had to go to the parking lots of churches and other community organizations to get Wi-Fi in order to access unemployment benefits so their kids could go to school. It's a real nightmare, and the telecoms are the ones who are responsible for it and are profiting from it.
Are these other countries, is there a consistent feature as to why they're providing better internet service than our country? I mean, is their infrastructure nationalized, or is it just simply heavily regulated to the point of, if you guys want, access to the users who are easy to provide service for, you have to provide it for everybody?
Yeah, so there are a range of models, Sam. I mean, there's certainly plenty of countries in which the primary internet service provider is still state-owned. There are others in which there's simply a lot more competition. You know, one of the features of the American landscape is that only four companies control 76% of all internet subscriptions, and they actively collaborate in order to not compete with one another. So we really have a cartel of broadband providers in this country, and that has driven up prices, driven down speeds. And that really consolidated in the years after 1995. There were some deregulatory moves that the George W. Bush era FCC in particular took to create, you know, what we have today, which is, a highly monopolized market.
So your book is written from a Marxist perspective in terms of its critique of our system now and in terms of, you know, where we want to head toward. What of antitrust? Where do you see antitrust fit into that calculus? Because the lack of it certainly exacerbated the problems. I'm curious as to if you think that one needs to go through antitrust to at least decentralize the power within the system to take the next step and make it, in certain areas, more nationalized or democratized?
Yeah, so, you know, anti-monopoly is certainly having a big moment currently. You know, a lot of Democrats and even a number of Republicans are pushing for more robust anti-monopoly enforcement in the tech sector. You know, my feeling about anti-monopoly is that it's a useful toolkit to constrain the power of these firms, but that I part ways with the anti-monopoly folks when it comes to our diagnosis of the problem. At the end of the day, I think the reason that we're seeing the problems that we're seeing with the internet are not because markets are too consolidated. It's the market itself is the problem. And so for my analysis is really trying to figure out, how can we diminish the power of the profit motive? How can we make markets matter less rather than markets work better? And I'll give you a concrete example. We've been talking about broadband, and it's, you know, without a doubt, one of the reasons that we have expensive service and low speeds is because of a highly consolidated market in broadband service. The anti-monopoly folks are absolutely right. But anti-monopoly isn't quite enough to get us to a better situation. You know, when you think about competition, competition is a fairly crude mechanism. It tends to work best for the customers who are worth competing for. And in fact, this is borne out by the data. When you look at how competition affects broadband prices, it tends to have the greatest effect on the highest cost broadband packages because people are competing more for those, you know, relatively better off customers. Competition is not going to help the folks who are in rural communities, who are in low income communities, who simply don't have the infrastructure in order to get connected. And that infrastructure is not going to pay for itself. A further thing that competition can't do is enable people to participate in the decisions that affect their everyday lives. One of the nice things about community networks is that they enable those types of democratic practices where people can come together and actually make choices together about how infrastructure is going to be deployed. A private firm, no matter how competitive the market is always going to be run by its executives and its investors, and it can't enable that type of democratic participation.
I'm curious. I mean, I agree with that assessment. Is it fair to say that from your perspective, antitrust is a tool in which to get closer to an elimination of profit as being the fundamental building block of the internet versus folks who see antitrust as an ends as opposed to a means.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it, Sam. I think antitrust, or the anti-monopoly toolkit more broadly, is essential. You know, it's essential for constraining the power of these big firms. But the question, as you point out, is what's our horizon? What's the world that we want? And for me, a world in which profit is pursued by smaller firms, by more entrepreneurial firms, won't fix the deeper problems of the internet.
It's fascinating. How is there any, do you have any hope? I mean, as we look at the landscape, I mean, I think in my mind, I certainly think we should be democratizing. I would like to democratize all of it, both like sort of the substructure and the infrastructure and the superstructure. I see antitrust as sort of like the necessary first step, because there's just too much consolidated power to go from here to there without first sort of making each one of these players, you know, drop them down a weight class or two, essentially. Do you have any hope that any of that is happening?
I do. You know, I think, look, it's not a particularly encouraging moment politically for those of us on the left. And I think we have to reckon with that and acknowledge it's not a high period of social mobilization, and doing anything about anything, including the internet, requires social mobilization. But the thing with the internet is sometimes people feel intimidated by the possibility of doing anything to transform it because it's so big. Right. And that makes sense. It is, in fact, very big and very complex, as we've been discussing. But the thing with the internet is that it exists at a number of different scales simultaneously. It is, in fact, global, but it's also national. It's also regional. It's also local. It's also hyperlocal. It, in fact, exists at the level of your neighborhood. And what that means is that there's actually a lot of surface area that we can attack. And when we talk about local broadband networks, it's very feasible for folks in their communities to get together and agitate for the construction of a local, publicly or cooperatively owned broadband network. And doing so will make a material difference in the lives of you and your neighbors, and more broadly will add to this demonstration effect that we've been talking about in order to persuade people that a different kind of internet is possible. So I think there's actually a lot we can do at the local level, particularly when at the national level in particular, things feel a bit blocked.
Ben Tarnoff, co-founder of Logic Magazine, author of The Internet for the People, The Fight for Our Digital Future. We will put a link to that at majority.fm as well as in our YouTube and podcast descriptions. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, folks. Going to head into the fun half. Did I say that too loud?
No.
You looked at me like I startled you.
No.
I'm glad to have my views on Marxism and antitrust validated by our guest.
Yeah, basically, I mean, I guess I was sort of pushing him in that direction.
And it's like the perfect interview for somebody to listen to who might want to be introduced to these kinds of ideas, because he doesn't get into the Marxism part until the very end. So you've already been eased into it.
There you go. Very sneaky of us.
So,
folks, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. And when you do, you not only get the free show free of commercials, but you also get the fun half. Mm. And just a reminder, gotten a couple of emails about how do we access the fun half. If you are a member and you want to see the fun half, head over to majority.fm. Log in as a member, and at the top of the of that day's post, today is Monday, July 11th. It'll say Monday, July 11th. Ben Tarnoff, The Internet for the People, Fight for Our Digital Future. In that post, you will see a link that we will place there after the show to what we say the fun half. Maybe we should just change that to it'll say the fun half. And then you click on that link, and there it is. It's a secret.
Okay. Well said.
Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Join our Discord. We fixed the link problem that we had at majoritydiscord.com. Pick up the app at majorityapp.com.
You want to join the Discord because, what, we hit 6,000 members the other day?
We have over 6,000.
Do you want to be a Johnny come lately to the Discord?
Yeah, don't show up as, like, member number 12,000.
Yeah, I mean, come on.
Until we get there.
And then please do.
Yes, of course. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Leckian media universe?
I had a great conversation with Milton Alamadi on his book Manufacturing Hate and about the secret racist history of things like the New York Times and National Geographic, which makes a lot of sense after you hear from Milton. I actually mowed lawns for a guy who had every copy of National Geographic magazine.
Ever?
Ever. It's wild to like go into back to the history of what that magazine was doing and type of things it was publishing. But patreon.com/leftreckoning to get access to that conversation.
See you in the fun half. 3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts!
Wait a second, hold on for a second. The Majority
Report. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt!
Boom. Fun hack. What is up, everyone? Fun
hack. Nomi Key.
You did it! Fun
hack. Let's go, Brandon.
Let's go, Brandon. Fun
hack. Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women.
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this,
7-8?
Yes.
Hi, me? Is this me?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm going to go for that
one. Libertarians.
They're so stupid, though.
Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him!
So, what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say.
857-210-3501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Poop.
You call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt.
Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled,
wow,
folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.